Monday night edition of the Dunk Time Basketball Podcast. We picked a great one to do a gamer on. Lots of really interesting games that we have to talk about. Some buzzer beaters as well. Big upsets. Our sponsors today, SeatGeek. You can use the CapSpace code to get a $20 rebate off of your first SeatGeek purchase. And a new sponsor today, Zeel, Z-E-E-L. Our listeners can get $25 off their first massage by going to zeel.com or on the Zeel app, Z-E-E-L app, and use the promo code CapSpace at checkout. Well, let's get started here with a little bit of news. Not a ton of it, but some that is pretty significant. Starting with more bad news for Jeremy Lin and the Brooklyn Nets, and great news for Celtics fans.
Lin had a re-aggravation of his hamstring injury and will be out another 3 to 5 weeks. We have seen the Jazz, other than that throttling of the Pelicans in one of the weirdest games of the season, we've seen them struggle just overall without him, and now another 3 to 5 weeks makes them the clear-cut front runner for worst record in the league.
Yeah, they're right now, the projections have them at like seven games behind teams like Philly and the Lakers. And while those projection systems don't know that Jeremy Lin's been out, it looks like he's going to be out most of that time, so we can't expect them really to improve over that time period. And just a re-injury, it's you really have to hope that this isn't going to be a Thiago splitter type of situation that's going to dog Lin for the rest of his career. But basically, you know, it's after the All-Star break, this is going to be like a lost year. I mean, I guess they'll try to get him back, but I mean, he was just working out trying to get back and then re-aggravating again. I mean, that's pretty crazy. I can't remember a hamstring injury that's lingered for this long with so little actual playing time. But while that is depressing, the Mo Williams saga continuing for us Cap Dorks is not depressing at all.
No, it is absolutely exhilarating. So what happened... It is, because this is the most, because it is such a great illustration. I kind of wish that this had happened before the new CBA, just as a great reminder of like, oh, you need to fix this thing. But so the short version of what happened now is that the Sixers claimed Mo Williams to try to get the salary floor savings and then waived him themselves. And Denver, the original team that acquired Mo Williams, picked him back up again. And I believe they've already waived him again. And so this cycle of cap floor shenanigans will be over, but hopefully not.
Maybe. Well, there's still teams that are below the floor too that could claim him again, like Minnesota or something, and then they could get the savings as well. But it actually ended up costing Philly money at this point, and Philly probably not gonna reclaim him again because they need to signed Chess and Randall again. And I was wrong yesterday, I guess, when I said that Mo had already cleared waivers or the time had already passed. That was not the case. And so at this point, the Sixers actually had to pay his salary, $38,000, had to spend $1,000 to claim him on waivers. And so they actually lost almost $40,000 with this maneuver, and we'll see what happens now. But pretty funny. The Hawks, at least their savings is locked in, and the Nuggets, maybe they will finally get the savings as well. But yeah, pretty amusing that we've had this saga, and I really just hope somebody else claims it so we can keep wasting time on this. But let's get to something that actually was kind of out of nowhere. I don't know how severely to take it, but because this wasn't like some big report, but Jeff McDonald just responding, he's the Spurs beat writer, responding to a question on Twitter, just said, well, Powell's going to opt in next year, Pau Gasol, and so the Spurs aren't really going to have much cap room. Gasol making about $15 million for next year. Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, that San Antonio being a team that could have potentially gotten a max space without Gasol's number. I mean, I think Powell is clearly going to want to stay there. You know, that's a way to opt in. The Spurs, if they really wanted to get crazy, could just stretch him and spread that $15 million
over 3 years.
Well, they
could just
trade
him. If that case, somebody would want him. He's not broken.
Yeah, that's probably true too. Yeah, you make a good point there.
Congratulations, you're going to go to like Phoenix.
Well, there's no evidence to indicate that that's what they're going to do. We'll see how the season ends, obviously.
But the other reason this is interesting is if that at the bare minimum, if that's just what the thinking is right now, it totally changes the way the Spurs handle Dwayne Dedmon, because Dedmon, if they're kind of a cap team, he only signed a 1 year contract. All they have are non-bird rights, and he's probably going to get paid this summer. So they might need to start looking for the next Dwayne Dedmon while they still have the current one.
Yeah, for San Antonio, could get to about $25 million in room if Gasol were to opt out. Everyone else else really on the roster who has a big salary is going to want to stay. And that also does not include Patty Mills. Mills, actually, you have to imagine that they will bring him back unless he gets an astronomical offer, because he has a low cap hold and they'll have his full bird rights as well. But so yeah, maybe we'll see how the season ends for them. If they're still in kind of that contender range, they probably won't shake things up too much. Okay, let's move on here to talking about these games. We're going to do Washington and Charlotte, a big road win for Washington. Golden State and Miami, Deion Waiters with the buzzer beating three after a frantic Golden State comeback. Milwaukee and Houston, great gains from Giannis and Jabari, bringing the Bucks past the Rockets. A little bit on New Orleans and Cleveland, since I didn't get a chance to watch all that. And then another buzzer beater from Russell Westbrook taking Oklahoma City past Utah. Those teams games are always fun too. First though, let's tell you about a new sponsor, Zeal. Valentine's Day is coming up, and we can make Valentine's Day really easy. You can get a couple's massage right at home with a private licensed massage therapist from Zeal, Z-E-E-L. So the way to get started with them, you go to zeal.com, or they have an iPhone and Android app. Z-E-E-L is the spelling. And you can select from top local licensed and pre-screened massage therapists. If you have a gender preference, you can choose that. Your favorite technique, time and location for your massage. And they have 8,000 licensed massage therapists that just bring a massage table, music, supplies, and give you a five-star massage. I actually am going to try mine out for the first time later this week, and really looking forward to it. I'll probably go for the sports massage. And of course, to get started with them, our listeners can get $25 off their first massage by going to zeal.com or using the Zeal app and using the promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. So that's Zeal, spelled Z-E-E-L.com, and make sure to click add a promo code at checkout to use my code CAPSPACE. Let them know that you came from us. All right, this Charlotte Washington game was a fun one. The Wizards took it 109-99. We can actually, I've resolved that we're actually going to like say what the scores of these games were in case like people didn't happen to like look at the scoreboard the day before. It really, though, was boiled down to John Wall and Brad Beal dominating their opposite numbers, Nicola Batum and Kemba Walker. Wall and Beal combined for 36 points and were relatively efficient from the field. And then Walker was 7 out of 24, 2 of 10 on threes, and Batum only 2 for 9. And when those two guys do not have it going for Charlotte, they are just not going to have much of a chance.
They even got a relatively effective performance from Marco Bellinelli, 5 of 12 from the field. Of course, he missed 6 threes, but that wasn't even enough. And surprisingly, though they've had been better over this little run that they've had, the Wizards bench was a major difference maker.
Another key difference here was that Washington bench. Jason Smith, Kelly Oubre, Trey Burke, all of them played well. They even made big runs at the start of the second and fourth quarter. The second, they didn't even have Wall or Beal on the floor. Fourth quarter, they did bring Beal in, and they are going lately with Markieff Morris at the four with that bench unit to give a little more scoring. Then in the first and third quarter, when Morris is out, they'll go with Kelly Oubre at the four. That's been relatively effective for them as a lineup. Also, Burke continues to play well. Jason Smith really is, despite the fact that we panned that contract, has actually been worth his $5 million this year. We'll see about the next 2 years as he gets into his early 30s. But for now, he actually has been effective for them at times. And I think this team is going to be a real playoff contender. I shouldn't say contender. I think they'll be a solid playoff team as long as A, the bench cannot get killed, and B, they can stay healthy. And that's been the case for them since they had what it was like a 3-10 start. They've been very good since then.
They have. They've also been awesome at home, and this was a road game, so significant in that way against a capable opponent. One of the biggest surprises for me in this game was Charlotte deciding that a way to combat Washington's defense was to use Cody Zeller, noted shooter Cody Zeller, as a pick and pop guy.
Well, you remember that when Zeller came into the draft, that was the big selling point. He played center at Indiana and he was going to be this stretch four and impressed in workouts. He has been a poor shooter since he's been in the NBA, but they were able to attack Gortat and get Zeller a few shots early. He was ended up 4-7 from the field. He had a pretty good game with 13 points and 9 boards in 35 minutes, had 3 steals and 2 blocks. I think he's a solid player. And, you know, they lost this by 10. He was only -1. But then Charlotte's bench bigs just have not been good. Kaminsky was -10. Hibbert was -9. He was getting couldn't really keep up very well with Jason Smith and his jump shooting. Bellinelli, though, he scored pretty well. missed some wide open threes late that really could have brought them back into it. And Charlotte is kind of turning into similar to Washington in a way, because they just do not have any depth at all. And that's why they're just so reliant on Kemba and Batum. And Kemba had a big struggle in this one from the field, in large part because he was just kept outside. He did manage to get 7 attempts at the rim, only made 4 of them. And then everything else was outside of 15 feet. Wasn't able to get that much penetration to set guys up either. And his jumper was falling quite well. It generally has been falling pretty well this year. He's averaging 23 a game after all. But in this one, it just wasn't falling, and it wasn't falling for Batum either.
I was thinking during this game about something, and this is not a criticism of the Hornets because they did this right, that if you're signing an a little bit of an older, non-mobile center, you do not want to make it a long-term contract, because when those guys fall off, they fall off so hard. Because with Hibbert, he was virtually unplayable for most of this game.
Yeah, and your other option is Spencer Hawes as well. I thought that with a guy like Jason Smith out there, maybe you would even try Kaminsky at center. Jeremy Lamb is out. I think they actually are missing him a little bit, much as that may annoy Steve Clifford that they are missing him, because he doesn't really care for his attitude, it seems like. But that impacts their ability to go small, and they really, I can't recall ever seeing them play Kaminsky at center, frankly. So that may not be in the cards, but perhaps that's a way that they could juice the offense a little bit on that second unit, because not only was Hibbert getting taken advantage of offensively, but or defensively, but we know that he's, you know, one of the worst offensive players in the league, really. A few more notes on this one. Nick Batum just has, we've talked in the 15 and 60 about how he can't get to the rim, but also like one of the shots that he would love to take last year was like off a dribble handoff or getting a screen coming to his right and then kind of turning into a three-pointer. He took one of those today that wasn't even close, and that's a very hard shot. Not a shot that he really took much of in Portland when he was more really a tertiary or fourth option, and just has not been able to sustain the efficient usage that he had last year. And that contract only goes up from here, as we've talked about. I guess the biggest thing that I took away from this game too, granted it was only one game, but just that John Wall to me is like well ahead of Kemba Walker still as a player, despite the wonderful season that Walker is having.
And that's even without Wall being the defensive just force that he was earlier. I thought he had a pretty solid game tonight, but Wall is more reliable at creating for himself and others. It also, he has the benefit of having teammates that are better suited for his game, but he outplayed him tonight.
And this Wizards team has been very difficult to stop. They put up a 114 offensive rating against the Charlotte team, and Brad Beal, his game, I don't know whether it's Scott Brooks telling him to do this or just him evolving as a player, but he took 16 shots and 9 of them were threes, and he made 4 of them. So even though he was only 6 out of 16 from the field, he still managed to score 18 points and be efficient. And he also really was stretching out the Charlotte defense quite a bit. We've talked about how Houston takes a lot of deep threes, and Beal really took 3 or 4 that were really deep behind the line that made that extra step or two very difficult to close out on. Anything else you wanted to talk about on this one?
Trey Burke had a pretty solid game. Not the greatest in terms of plus minus, but 4 assists is better than usual for him. And I think he's benefited.
That might be like his career high in assists.
It also, it
certainly
looks...
certainly an assist per minute. Like he has been, you know, not at all a playmaker in his career, which was a disappointment coming out of Michigan when he was a pretty good pick and roll guy.
It looks to me like he's benefiting from Markieff Morris being out there a little bit more with his minutes, because Morris can just, he can convert opportunities that are created by other people, and so it's not all on Burke to do everything himself.
Yeah, Burke had a nice drive, a sweep behind the back to Markieff for a dunk, just the sort of plays that you don't see that much from Burke, and got into the mid-range for a couple of nice pull-up jumpers. And the only other last thing I had in my notes here was that Kaminsky, you would hope being 7 foot that he could really make some hay against a guy like Markieff Morris, who's kind of just a normal power forward size guy, but not like a great post defender, you don't think. And Frank, he does have that kind of T-Rex wingspan, but, and he's got all these skills where he likes all these up and unders and spin moves and stuff, but he never just like goes to a jump hook back down and shoots it. Like his initial, he doesn't have any confidence in just his initial move. He doesn't ever shoot a turnaround jump shot. He rarely just goes to a jump hook. He always wants to fake and go for a step through or something. And when the defense doesn't bite on it, then he doesn't have anything and he's just kind of stuck there and has to do a desperate pass out, and you've wasted most of the possession.
Broadly speaking, I think he's more confident in his small guy skills than his big guy skills.
Yeah, it is. I think that's right. He likes to face the basket and he is good at driving, not even necessarily to finish, but just to draw help and kick. He's not going to finish over guys at the rim or anything, but he yeah, I think he is much more comfortable facing the basket. But if he's going to play as a power forward, part of the idea was that he was going to be unstoppable in the post. And that's not really been the case, even against most players, especially guys who are his size. Should we move on to Golden State and Miami?
You mean to Dion Waiters? Yes.
Yeah, Waiters was unbelievable in this one. A 105-102 victory for Miami, in which he, of course, hit the game-winning step-back three-pointer over Klay Thompson after Golden State had tied it. Waiters was 13 of 20 from the field, 6 of 8 on three-pointers for 33 points. Only got to the foul line one time, which is pretty amazing, and only turned it over three times, which is pretty impressive. It basically was just him making tough, contested jump shots. Like, he took three shots in the restricted area all night, made two of them, only took 6 of his 20 shots in the paint. And those 6 three-pointers, I mean, how many of those were even open? Like, the two in the last 5 minutes were just really tough contested looks.
The one over Draymond in particular, in my opinion.
Yeah, that which, and I think we'll go through the last couple of minutes here, because I thought there are a lot of interesting observations to make on the Golden State side, surprisingly, even though they lost this game, because this is really the first time that they've played very well in the clutch, even though they lost. I was just impressed by Okoro White's defense. He just got called up, signed on a hardship exemption by Miami from Sioux Falls, which has just been a factory for them, even though they don't have any guys there that you think of as like great prospects necessarily. They just make these guys out of there who can defend really well. And White, kind of like a combo forward size guy, but a little skinny, clearly has a lot of length, a lot of intensity defensively. And while, you know, he only scored 2 points, he wasn't like, or I'm sorry, he actually had 5 points. But he was in there at the end a lot, playing defense. They brought him in as a defensive sub, and just watching him play D, I kind of want to see more of him. Maybe he'll just end up being terrible on offense, but I liked just the little snippets that I saw from him defensively.
Yeah, I liked him too. Another thing, I talked about this a lot on Locked On Warriors, which I already recorded, but the Warriors had some of the worst turnovers in the earlier parts of this game that they've had all year. Just like one behind the back pass from Curry that was unbelievably bad, a couple of bad ones from Draymond and Sean Livingston. And in a game this close, anything can make the difference. Dion Waiters going off makes a difference and all that, but they need to tighten that up. Even just a little bit would help them so much.
I only really watched the last 5 or 6 minutes to this one. How the hell did Hassan Whiteside only go 4 out of 13? Were they just like trying to post him up and he couldn't make them?
That was some of it. He also shot a couple of mid-range shots. There was one series, I knew you would have gone crazy if you were watching it, where Whiteside and Zaza Pachulia traded mid-rangers, and I'm just sitting there going, what are you guys doing? So that was a part of it, and they were also doing a good job of making every shot he took difficult. So yeah, I think it was a little bit of that. They also fouled him a couple times when he probably would have gotten a better look, but he didn't make that shot and then went to the free throw line.
The other Heat player really who was big in this one was Luke Babbitt, going 3 out of 4 from 3-point range. And Babbitt, a good shooter, that's really all he does, of course. He couldn't hit a shot in that game in Oakland. And the Heat actually got a lot of wide open shots in that game in Oakland, a game in which Klay Thompson was rested, but they really just couldn't convert them. And they did hit him in this game to the tune of 13 out of 30 on 3-pointers. And that was really the difference, because Golden State couldn't hit a shot to save their lives.
They could not. They were 8 of 30 from 3, and now after this game, the six of 9 times that they've shot 30% or below from 3, they've lost. And that's all but one of their losses. The only time they were over it was that win was the loss against Memphis in Memphis, which was mostly garbage time anyway, because they got their butts kicked in the first half.
David West hit a couple of threes in that game.
Correct. Yeah, which lended, when I can't remember who was it Mike Prada said like, oh, David West is at threes this year. It wasn't Malinowski. And we're like, what? And it was in the garbage time of that game.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a strange circumstance for a lot of those different reasons. And it was engaging late. And I think that's why you want to go through it a little bit.
Yeah, KDU was 1 out of 8. Draymond, nightmare shooting, 1 of 4 from the line, 0 of 3 on threes. Curry and Thompson weren't great either. But it was really looking ugly for Golden State. They were down 10 with 3 minutes left in this game. And then I tweeted out that this actually would be a good test to see, because last year's team had so many of those games where down 10 with 5 minutes left. I mean, your win expectancy is probably, you know, 2% at that point if you're a normal team. Games that they got back into. And I wanted to say, all right, let's see if they can do it. You know, usually a good rule of thumb is basically you're going to get 2 possessions every minute. So they're down 10. They had to make up 10 points in six possessions, and they did it almost immediately. They went on an 8-0 run in four possessions, two threes and a two-pointer, and really cranked up the defense. And with 2 minutes left, they managed to get Miami switching everything, which again was what they had struggled with quite a bit. Whiteside was out of the game. Steve Kerr, with a very smart move to foul Whiteside, he missed both of his free throws. You remember he did the same thing late against Rudy Gobert in that comeback win they had against the Jazz very late in the year. That was key towards them getting the 73. And when they to get within five, Golden State really took advantage of the switching in ways that they had not been able to before. They got a pin down for Livingston to Steph Curry. Andre Iguodala was resting in this one. Curry blew right past Dragic and then threw to KD on the weak side to get the Warriors within two. And you thought that it was over at that point. The Heat call a timeout with a minute 47 left. They run a bunch of stuff. They're just Warriors are switching everything. Draymond Green gets onto Waiters and just hits a crazy step back three going to his left to put Miami up five. And then it looked like Miami was going to be fine. Whiteside came back in and Steph tried to drive on him. KD missed another open three. They got the offensive rebound and then Sean Livingston threw it out of bounds. So basically with a minute left at that point, I mean, that was one of those inexplicable turnovers that you were talking about there. Golden State was still down by five.
Yeah, it was a completely ridiculous circumstance. And then Waiters has the ball because he dominated the ball during this late stretch. Not a bad thing.
Yeah, they were just giving it to him to dribble it up. I mean, Dragic was just getting out of the way. He was only 5 out of 14 and just
like last year,
go to work. Yeah.
And Clay forced him to drive left. And then eventually Draymond ended up
right. You mean, this was interesting because you could tell that every time Clay was ISO'd on Waiters, the scouting report was send him to his right because he likes to shoot that step back to his left. And he's been a horrible finisher this year at the rim. And so Clay forced him to his right. Draymond did not force him to his right on that crazy step back three that he made, and Draymond forced him to miss at the rim. They executed perfectly, and then both Waiters basically crashed into the baseline. Whiteside went for the offensive rebound, and that led to Golden State pushing it up and getting an alley-oop from Green to Durant that looked like it was almost going to be over his head to get within three. And you figured at that point the Warriors would go for a three again if they got the ball back. Waiters was definitely less enthused about attacking Kevin Durant. You could tell that KD had probably guarded him in practice and was in Waiters' head a little bit, and KD forced him to his right, and Waiters just about missed everything. Whiteside again went for the offensive rebound, didn't get it, and Miami was incredibly worried about Steph getting a three-pointer, so he was able to just find Livingston for an easy dunk. On that play, though, while you want to take a dunk, the shot clock was off. There's 21 seconds left, and he had KD in the corner wide open for a three. Probably might have to have that over again, would have passed it, but when you have a wide open dunk, you're probably going to take it.
Even all the way back yet, so the Warriors probably would have gotten the offensive rebound if he'd missed.
Yeah, then there was a sequence where the Warriors did a great job denying the ball in bounds. Wayne Ellington caught it, had to call an immediate timeout because he got trapped. Then they're stuck in the corner. They tried to inbound it to Dragic. KD kicked the ball, and then they, with like 4.95 seconds, finally got the ball into Dragic, and they had to foul, but he only made 1 out of 2 free throws. And then the Warriors advanced the ball and ran what I thought was a really good play down two in that situation. There was a lot going on, but they were able to execute it and take advantage of the Miami switching and cause some miscommunications. What did you think of the fact that Eric Spoelstra took Hassan Whiteside out of the game on that play?
I didn't think that the Warriors were going to be able to exploit it, and defensively he made a difference at the rim, and while that wasn't the anticipated part of the play, you could always go for a two if that's the opportunity there, and the Warriors certainly were more aggressive in driving when Hassan Whiteside was not on the floor. That ended up rearing its head late. So yeah, they were running all the switching stuff, but once Durant got a step on his man, he got all the way in for that dunk with about 11.6 left.
About 11.6. Give or take a tenth of a second. The play play that I was talking about, they started off with Steph Curry way in the backcourt, and KD screened for Klay. They switched that. Then Draymond screened KD into the corner. And then after that switch, Draymond sprinted towards Curry, who got the ball on the run going forward into the front court. The Heat were freaked out about Curry, obviously. Double teamed him. It almost functioned like a pick and roll. Draymond got the ball. They had to help on him. Threw it to KD in the corner. James Johnson did a great job of running Durant off the line. But then there was nobody there at the rim. I think Livingston was engaged with waiters, and Durant was able to just go right in and dunk it to tie the game, at which point the Heat were out of timeouts because they had to waste their last one on the inbound the time before. But Dion Waiters doesn't need a timeout.
Would you have had Klay Thompson on Dion Waiters in that circumstance? Like, obviously you have to call it on the fly because there were no timeouts, but I would have had either Durant or Draymond out there because I thought Draymond did a good job defending almost everybody on switches.
Yeah, you know, I didn't see it was like Waiters lighting up Klay earlier in the game as well. Was that like a big part of his scoring?
No, it wasn't really like that. He was basically scoring on whoever was in front of him, but Klay, I don't think Klay ever really had a handle for Waiters in the way that Durant does because those guys were teammates most of last year.
Yeah, and when you have a guy that you know wants to take the jumper, Durant doesn't have a lot of weaknesses in one-on-one defense. Like, the way to attack him, if you're going to, is go hard one direction and then cross over, because his change of direction defensively is not amazing. But if you're going to try to go for like some kind of step back or something, like, his length is going to be a major problem. That's what Waiters likes to do. And Klay blamed himself after the game for not getting up on Waiters. He thought it was bad defense. I mean, it's a shot that's contested. It's probably still, you know, a 30% shot by just about anyone, but he still could have done better because he again was trying to force him right but didn't get close enough to him. So Waiters was able to go between his legs to his left, and Klay was kind of orienting him to the left. So once Waiters was able to cross over, Klay was still kind of facing the wrong direction and then wasn't able to get much of a contest on Waiters. It looked like he was kind of there, but Waiters was very comfortable with his shot and was able to put it in, leaving only 0.6 left for the Warriors. And Steph threw up a desperation shot that he wasn't able to get. I would have liked to have seen that play be for Kevin Durant, just because Durant has so much more height than Steph. Steph has a low release. I think Durant would have had a little bit better chance of getting a shot off, but with 0.6 seconds left and needing a three, that really didn't matter. That your chances of winning there are not very high anyway.
Yeah, no real issue with that. Durant would have been better, but I didn't see him as being particularly open, and then it looked like the play was run for Steph anyway.
Yeah, but for me, they had this crazy early game in Orlando the day before. Then there was no shoot around. They were in Miami that night. It was Iguodala wasn't playing. It was somewhat predictable that this would be a struggle of a game. They usually have struggled against Miami since LeBron James left, even when Miami has been relatively shorthanded. And this Miami team, of course, plays really hard no matter who's out there. Spo has done a fantastic coaching job this year. But if anything, I actually would be encouraged for the Warriors because they were able to summon that crazy clutch gear really for the first time this season. And they'd been a bad clutch team. And I think even though they ended up losing on a crazy shot, what they were able to do offensively down the end of the game, I think they actually can derive some confidence from that.
Sure. And also, a lot of the ways that they struggled in this game were aberrations. Dion Waiters going off, shooting below 30% from three. The turnovers will probably stay in some form, but maybe not to the degree that they happened in this game and at the levels, like at certain moments where they happen. But not the biggest deal in the world. That's why you try to win a lot of your other games and dominate those, so that you can lose a coin flip or another team having a great game every once in a while.
Yeah, Dion Waiters, by the way, Cooper Moorhead tweeted this out. He was 3 of 20 on pull-up threes going into this game, and he shot significantly better than 15% on those shots in this one. Another play too was Zaza just got a flagrant for no reason on Luke Babbitt. He really was
popped
quite
him in the face.
He almost, yeah, just and he almost even like tried to get into it. They put him in just to get the defensive rebound on that Dragic free throw, and James Johnson pushed him into the basket. He almost had an altercation with him. So Zaza kind of lost his cool a little bit, and that flagrant did not help much. The Warriors would have won the game probably had it not been for that. Let's get to Milwaukee and Houston, but first, a message from our old friends at SeatGeek. Concert tickets, musicals, sports tickets, basically anything that you need a ticket for, SeatGeek is your go-to. Two great things about SeatGeek. Number one, they aggregate ticket selling sites together, so you don't have to worry about going to a bunch of different sites. You just went to 8 sites, now you have to go to the 9th site because you're worried that you might have missed out on a deal. You don't have to worry about that with SeatGeek. And then the other thing is they help you find the best price ticket fast by giving it a rating with their proprietary deal score technology. Green is good, red is not so good in terms of a deal. So you can look in the general area that you want to sit, pick out the green tickets, and rest assured that you're getting the best deal. Danny has worked in the ticket business. He has a great eye for this stuff, but agrees with usually what the algorithm says about what's a good deal. And now ticket buying is not annoying anymore. It's just something that you can finish in 90 seconds once you sign up with that free SeatGeek app. You can download it and, of course, click on add a promo code. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first SeatGeek purchase using the promo code CAPSPACE, which, of course, we discuss all the time on the program, so it's easy to remember. And let them know as well that you came from us. That's the free SeatGeek app, promo code CAPSPACE, to get $20 off once you have made your first SeatGeek purchase. Let's get to Milwaukee and Houston. I didn't see quite as much of this one as I had planned to initially, just because that Warriors game and the Cleveland-New Orleans game ended up being really close down the end. And Milwaukee actually ended up handling Houston with some degree of comfort late. The key stretch in this one was the start of the fourth quarter, which I went back and rewatched, in which the Bucks went on an 11-0 run, and it really didn't start off well for them at all. They had Giannis out of the game, Harden was out too, and Houston ran one of their signature plays four times in a row. We've talked about this play before on the program. Basically, what you imagine is Patrick Beverley starting with the ball in his hands. Usually it'll be Harden, but he was out, and then Eric Gordon and whoever the screener is, in this case Capella, stand in a stack at the free throw line, and the big will go and set the pick and roll. Gordon will then set a back screen on the big's man, or whoever really he wants to, whoever's in help position, and then he will pop out to the three-point line afterwards. And it really was difficult for Milwaukee to deal with. Houston got great looks four times in a row. Finally, Milwaukee ended up just switching it, and that worked a little bit better because Harden wasn't on the floor. Houston didn't really have anyone who was going to take advantage as much of the switches. But once Houston tied the game at 99 using that play, they got great defense from Jason Terry, of all people. He stole it from Eric Gordon twice, just like right out of his hands. And the Bucks got a ton of fast breaks off this time period. A Terry three, Jabari Parker had a layup, Monroe got fouled in transition, Parker got fouled in transition. All those basically were turnovers, with Terry had a couple of steals, and then the roll man flubbed passes on the pick and roll a couple of times too. It was Capella, and then they even brought Harden back in along with Nene, and they still had another turnover, had to call a timeout. And then the Bucks couldn't really score that well without Giannis on the floor, but they got out in transition so much. And then the one play where they weren't in transition, Brogdon hit this ridiculous shot late clock going to his right, basically at the elbow. He's a right-handed shooter, shot a 1 foot shot off of his right foot. I have no idea how he was able to like smoothly get this up. He was being guarded by Capella, and he just was able to get it up over Capella. Incredible play by him, and that was the game. It went from tied to Bucks by 11, and I don't think it got closer than six the rest of the way. The Bucks ended up winning 127-114.
Also, big overall performances from Giannis and Jabari. They combined for 59 points, 15 rebounds and 10 assists, which is pretty impressive from your starting forwards. And
seven assists by Jabari, by the way. You'd think correct. That it was Giannis. Jabari has had some big assist games lately as well. He had 9 assists. I can't remember who it is against. We actually did that game, but more passing from Jabari, more with the ball in his hands as well.
The part of the game that I saw most of, I flipped back and forth with this and a couple other ones, was actually the other really bad stretch for the Rockets, which was, I believe, was at the beginning of the second quarter when James Harden was out, and they got absolutely torched by the Bucks. And that contributed a lot to not only James Harden being plus 5 in a 13-point loss, but also Corey Brewer being negative 22 in 6 minutes. He was just abysmal. He missed one shot and just had a couple bad rotations, and just that Rockets lineup just couldn't put it together a little bit offensively, like what they had the trouble with in the fourth quarter.
You're being a little mean to Brewer. My box score that I have up says that he actually played 7 minutes and was negative 22. but yeah, it was definitely a rough performance for Brewer. Ryan Anderson was back in this game. He shot it pretty well. Sam Decker had 30 in that game against Memphis when he actually took Brewer's starting spot. Really, I see no reason at this point. And Decker didn't shoot it that well. He was back in, I think, for the first time back where he went to school in Wisconsin. But I don't see why you wouldn't just play Decker 23 minutes and Brewer 0 at this point. Although he is like a vet, he's got some gravitas in the locker room. I mean, he's been awful for 2 years now. Anderson, while he did shoot it well, had big time struggles trying to guard Jabari. Just couldn't do anything with him one-on-one. And I just like that the Bucks put the ball in Jabari's hands more. He got 11 and 19 from the field for Jabari with those 7 assists, 3 steals as well, which you don't see too often from him. Brogdon had 4 steals. Monroe had 3 steals. The Bucks overall 17 steals in this game of the 21 Rockets turnovers. I mean, that's a crazy ratio that 17 of your 21 turnovers would be steals. The Rockets just were kind of kicking the ball all over the gym in this game, but good Bucks defense to be sure. But when Greg Monroe and Jason Terry and Brogdon, not even really like that big of a steals guy either, are getting a ton. Well, Jabari too, like you realize that it's probably you making the mistakes more than them making great plays.
Right. And on the prior note, I thought a couple points in this game, I got concerned for the Rockets moving forward, because while Ryan Anderson is a very good player and has been a wonderful addition when healthy for them, he has trouble with not only offensively capable fours, but especially fours that are good with the ball in their hands. And that is a relatively rare skill set. However, a lot of the best teams in the Western...
That's why Jabari is awesome.
Yeah. However, a lot of the best teams in the Western Conference have those guys. They might face Blake Griffin in the first round. Blake Griffin is that. Draymond Green, certainly that. LaMarcus Aldridge is a different kind of good player, but he can do well in isolations and in various circumstances to take advantage of Ryan Anderson. And while Draymond is a great help defender, the other two, it's not as big of a deal if he, you know, if, as long as you just keep a guy on him, you're taking away their help defense. So that is a concern in terms of their viability. I mean, it's not the end all be all for the Rockets. They still have James Harden. He's an MVP candidate, maybe even the front runner, but it is a concern when they're facing the best of the best. And Jabari.
Yeah, that's a good point. And in fact, they had to go and had some success with this in the third quarter with Capella guarding Jabari, and then they were just switching everything at that point, but the Bucks couldn't make them pay because they just didn't have the spacing to take guys one-on-one, and the Bucks are not, you know, don't have like the Warriors level of refinement against switching defenses to really make them pay with like slipping screens and that sort of thing. But they needed a little bit more shooting on the floor. Some interesting rotation changes for the Bucks, who had lost 5 straight coming in. Miles Plumlee started at center. John Henson did not play at all. Matthew Dellavedova did not, as it turned out, get Wally pipped by Malcolm Brogdon. He was back in the lineup, actually played a nice game with 16 points on only 8 shooting possessions for Delly. 2 of 3 on 3, 7 assists. I think they wanted him out there defensively. Tony Snell, I thought, was pretty good on Harden. Harden did have 26 points on and 12 assists, 4 steals, but he also had 11 turnovers of his own, which is pretty ridiculous. Missed the quadruple double by 1 rebound. But I think that Snell actually, like, defensively is, now that he's gotten a little bit stronger, actually is starting to be like a more viable stopper. I mean, he can't guard like really big wings, but he wasn't, he actually did okay on Harden, and he was 3 of 3 from the field. All 3 of those were threes as well. And of course, because he was on the Bucks in this game, he had 2 steals of his own.
By rule, I'm really intrigued by the rest of this Rockets road trip. So they already got that nice win in Memphis and then lost tonight, but they face Boston, Philly, and the Pacers before they head home. And if they get 2 out of 3, that's pretty good. And that's a basic considering it's the Pacers and the Sixers. But I want to see each one of those games. Even, we're not going to talk about Pacers Knicks, but I'm going to be intrigued to see how Indiana defends him, meaning Harden.
Greg Monroe was pretty good in this one too. 17 points and 10 rebounds in only 27 minutes. He still is the best center on the Bucks. But for him to play 27 minutes and Plumlee 20, that seems like a reasonable amount. And Plumlee was pretty good offensively. He had 10 points in his 20 minutes, was able to make some plays out of the pick and roll. He's their best pick and roll finisher due to his athleticism. So we'll see what keeps happening with the Bucks center roulette. They also actually played Mirza Teletovic. Michael Beasley did not play at all, and that's how it should be. Beasley has scored much better. He's actually been good at times this year, but Teletovic, he just spaces the floor so much. He was on the floor when they made both of their big runs. He was plus 12, even though he's only 1 of 4, 0 of 3 on threes. He gets guarded out there, and that's really the only guy in the Bucks that opponents aren't going to leave. And when you consider that he's a big as well, he just does so much for this team.
They were playing him at least in one of those stretches with Giannis and one of their centers, and it works reasonably well. You know, it's not perfect, but Teletovic is, as you said, a player who other teams respect, and Giannis gets so much of a benefit from having just that modicum of extra spacing on the floor. Also, I'm not sure if you saw it, but I thought his alley-oop was pretty ridiculous from Terry, because it wasn't a great throw. He didn't catch it cleanly. It kind of rocked on his wrist, and he dunked it one-handed anyway. It was ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was one of those ones where Terry was at about half court, so was Giannis, and then you saw Giannis start streaking towards the rim, and you knew like three steps before that it was going to be an alley-oop, and it was just a question of whether he was going to catch it or not, and it was awesome. Yeah. Go watch the highlights of that one. Let's get to a little bit on New Orleans Cleveland here. I only was able to catch the very end of this one, but another loss without Anthony Davis, in which Ty Lue went for this one. LeBron James had a triple double with 26 and 12, but had six turnovers. He's been turning the ball over a lot lately. 26 points, 12 rebounds, or 12 assists, 10 rebounds. 44 minutes in this one, 42 for Kyrie Irving, 38 for Kevin Love. Kyrie had 49 points, tried to bring them back in the second half, but they were down 70-50 at halftime. I mean, just inexcusable defense to give up 70 points to this Pelicans team without AD. They have like one guy on this team who can do anything off the dribble.
Also, when you think about the ways that New Orleans can generate efficient offense, you go, oh, well, maybe they turn the ball over a ton. Well, New Orleans had five steals, but Miami only had seven turnovers total. I mean, Cleveland, sorry.
Miami. Yeah. Wow. That's a LeBron flashback right there.
Ah, not that far back. but I thought that was intriguing just during this game, was that the ways that New Orleans was generating offense, and part of that was just because Terrence Jones decided, well, Deion Waiters is having the game of his life, I might as well have the game of my life too.
36 points for Jones on 23 shooting possessions, three block shots as well, including a nasty block on LeBron as LeBron went in for a dunk, thought better of it, and then got his layup just thrown back in his face late by Jones. That was a key play. And then Drew Holiday had 33 points of his own, 12 and 19 from the field. I wonder who is supposed to be guarding him on Cleveland, by the way. And really just, I don't want to go too far here. The Pelicans did really well. They blocked 11 Cleveland shots, but still couldn't stop them down the end. Kyrie was 15 out of 28 from the field, 8 of 14 on threes, and was plus 12 in this one. James actually was negative 10. Rare that usually it's Kyrie when he's will have the bad numbers, and LeBron will be good in the plus minus. But LeBron has had some pretty bad games lately. This being one of them, I thought it was kind of flummoxed down the stretch. He got lit up defensively at the end. Like, he got switched on to Terrence Jones and just like couldn't stop Terrence Jones in the post. I was like really surprised to see that. He had another play where they're trying to foul late. They actually could have gotten a steal, and you would think they'd be pressing, and as when they pressed, he just like stayed under the New Orleans basket, didn't try to run back and foul, and then Jones threw a horrible pass to Solomon Hill that Kyle Korver deflected, and there was just nobody there to get the ball. And if LeBron had actually run back, he might have gotten it. So, I mean, the debate here is, all right, are the Cavs just not trying? Are they bored? Do these issues mean anything to the fact that they got killed by Golden State, that they had this bad road trip? Like, does that augur anything bad for the playoffs, or is this just them coasting and not trying, and that's just what they do?
I lean more towards the latter, and especially now that it's becoming abundantly clear that they're not going to have a better record than at least the top two teams in the West, the motivation to push for every single game is just not there.
Yeah, and Toronto is having, you know, lost to Charlotte by a billion points. They lost at home to Phoenix. Like, nobody's exactly breathing down the Cavs' neck here right now, and they're still 30 and 13, although only 11 and 9 on the road, and their point differential is like, you know, three or something now. Now they I think they've lost like three or four games when LeBron is sat, so you can throw that in there too, but they definitely are not playing at peak intensity. LeBron had a couple of bad turnovers down the end too, and you know, you can make the argument that hey, they're not trying that hard defensively, but is LeBron like turning the ball over because he's not trying hard enough offensively when he's like trying to drive to the rim? You know, I'm not going to necessarily buy that either.
Fair point.
But we won't know the answer to these questions until the end of the season. And they dominated the Eastern Conference playoffs last year, of course. They lost that game at home to San Antonio over the weekend again, but you know, LeBron shot the ball really well in that game. It hit like a crazy three to tie it. So, I mean, I'm not going to like hit the panic button for the Cavs or anything. I mean, they're going to make the finals in all likelihood. But if you're talking about, hey, trying to beat some of these teams out west, including Golden State, they've got some work to do defensively. I think that's pretty clear.
They'll have a long time to figure it out, but they actually have to do it. And they're not going to get really tested. I mean, because Toronto is a very different kind of offensive team. If Boston's the team they face, they're so reliant on Isaiah. They are not going to face that multi-pronged attack like the Warriors or the Spurs until the finals.
For the Pels, this massive win got them all the way up to a 3% chance of making the playoffs. They're still
the peninsula. The peninsula is still in danger.
All right, let's move on to the last game of the day. OKC and Utah. Another absolutely awesome game. And I thought that this was really, I think, the only the second time that Utah has lost with both George Hill and Gordon Hayward in the lineup. And part of the reason for that was that neither of those guys really was able to do much. Hayward 6 out of 17 from the field, Hill 2 out of 10. That was a big part of why they lost, those guys just not hitting the shots that they normally would.
I wrote this game up for the League Pass Games of the Week. I thought it was going to be intriguing. It certainly was. And one of my notes was, this could be a great chance for George Hill, who has been underrated for so many years, to really show what his value is on both ends of the floor. And it was not exactly that George Hill game. He struggled offensively, 2 of 10 from the field, 0-4 from 3, despite being an awesome catch and shoot guy. And Russell Westbrook was, you know, he had some struggle moments in this game, but was monstrous late and ended up with a pretty much trademark Russell Westbrook game. 38 points, 11 to 29 from the field, 10 rebounds, 10 assists, 6 turnovers. That's about standard for him.
54% usage in this game for Russell Westbrook as well when he was on the floor, which is pretty crazy. 13 of 17 from the line, 4 steals, massive defensive lapse that let the Jazz tie the game. And we can go through some of the key plays down the end. Alec Burks actually was the big engine for the Jazz. Great to see him looking explosive, being back in it. He had some of those Houdini finishes, looked so fast off the pick and roll, was able to go right at Cantor a couple of times once the Jazz stopped trying to get too cute and just went after him, because Oklahoma City closed with the Twin Towers. Snyder had Diaw in. Diaw wasn't doing as well defensively, and then they went back to Favors to go up against Adams and Cantor with Gobert. That was just an old school bloodbath. Really enjoyable to see that match up in the paint. Burks had a couple of nice drives, and I think they actually had a chance to take the lead with about a minute 30 left. Actually, it was under a minute left. Thunder up by 1. Burks with a beautiful drive, shovels it to Favors, looks like he's going to have a wide open dunk. Steven Adams comes out of nowhere, blocks Favors, gets into Westbrook's hands, and then Adams outruns everybody for a dunk to put him up 3. That was the key play in the game. Just great play by Steven Adams. And then the next time down the floor, Rudy Gobert stepped up hard on a Russell Westbrook pick and roll late in the clock. Westbrook took the jumper over him anyway, and that left the offensive boards exposed with both Cantor and Adams there. Adams was able to get the rebound with under 24 seconds left. The Jazz missed a chance to foul Adams when he was kind of grappling around the ground, and they actually got it to Westbrook, after which the Jazz had to foul him to get within 3. And then Westbrook, with just an absolute brain fart, resulting in a 3 for Gordon Hayward out of the timeout play.
Oh, God. I mean, it was one of those circumstances when you realize the difference between Westbrook's defensive capabilities, his reputation, and what he actually does, because he just has those moments where you just sit there and go, how did that happen?
Now, we don't know for sure that it was Westbrook's fault, but it probably was. Usually, especially when the other team needs a 3, you're going to be in switch everything mode because you just don't want someone to come off a screen and hit a shot. And Rudy Gobert screened for Hayward, set a nice screen on Robertson. And then George Hill also set a screen on Steven Adams. Steven Adams stayed with Hill because they were switching. And Russell Westbrook was just standing in the lane and never moved as Hayward just came right to the ball and made a 3. I think it was pretty clear that Quinn Snyder designed the play knowing that Westbrook would be on George Hill, having him set the final screen, just because he is kind of prone to those mental breakdowns. I don't know if that's what they were thinking, but it certainly worked out well. I mean, that's in a need a 3 situation. You're never going to get a more wide open shot than that. And Hayward tied it. That led to what I thought was a brilliant move by Billy Donovan, calling timeout, but then actually letting Westbrook go the length of the floor.
I like it too, because it stretches the other team's defense out a little bit. And the Jazz tried to run pick and roll defense, but no.
Well, yeah. And George Mitchell, as you noted, kind of struggled in this one. Just was the Thunder were setting great screens. He wasn't able to get over the screens very well. Westbrook was loath to attack Rudy Gobert inside, took a lot of jump shots.
Except for that one dunk.
Which he missed, though, still. And he did get to the foul line quite a bit, too. So to say that like he wasn't effective going to the rim, that's probably not accurate. But on this play, they had Russ go full speed, get up ahead of steam, which is where he's so unstoppable. And they had Steven Adams set the screen just over half court. That was really, and then he moved and just held the crap out of George Hill too. Gobert was thinking about coming out on Westbrook. Westbrook could have just pulled up for the three, would have been wide, wide open. Gobert didn't want to come out though, probably in part because they'd given up the offensive rebound on the prior possession. And that was just kind of in his head that he wanted to be able to protect the glass. Hill was able to get back into the play, but Westbrook just rose up right over him and stuck the jumper with a second left, but really just a nice play call. I still wonder, and it would have been hard with Westbrook at this type of speed too, why teams, I still have not seen a single team try to trap Westbrook. And you think it just, this Thunder team is so ripe for it with the lack of shooting and playmaking they have other than him. But it, and maybe Westbrook's just too fast for that. And but Gobert actually has the mobility maybe to do that. Or they could have also just gone with favors up there and kind of more of a zone too, just whoever went up to set the screen, favorites could have guarded him, done like that Hyde Brook Lopez thing that the Nets kind of started doing. I know, but Westbrook made a great shot. And then Utah actually got a pretty good look for Alec Burks coming to the corner to hit a three that could have won it, but Burks wasn't able to hit.
It was a tough look. And something I was thinking about, I agree with you on the trapping idea, is with Oklahoma City, it's pretty obvious who they're going to be using as the screener. To have it in a circumstance where it's somebody else that you're comfortable screening, because if it's just putting another small on Adams in that circumstance and just switching it, what are they going to do? Are they going to post up Steven Adams with 3 seconds left in the game? No, they're not going to do that. So just have another guy out there who you feel comfortable, like Alec Burks, comfortable guarding Russ, and just switch it.
Yeah, I think there's a concern that you're going to get hurt on the offensive glass there. And also just that you want, with Russell Westbrook out there, you want guys waiting at the rim. I mean, you're not going to take,
well, I'm not saying take those
game,
guys but... out. I'm saying put them on other guys and have them empowered to help. And then if you give up an open three to Jeremy Grant, so be it.
Yeah, Grant was out of the game. They put in Abrines, but I think they still had Robertson in the game at the end. So yeah, it would have been nice to get a little bit more help there, especially when it became clear that Russ was going to get wide open. But I thought, again, Donovan just did a great job, reminiscent of what the Bulls did in game three of the 91 finals, where they were down two and just had Michael Jordan bring the ball the length of the floor and hit a jumper over Vlade Divac to tie it. You just get the team just a little bit more in flux. And with Russ's best attribute is his speed. I just really like that move from Donovan. Some other notes from earlier in this game. The Jazz tried to go with Joe Johnson, and he got just completely erased by the athleticism of Jeremy Grant. Joe tried to ISO on him a couple of times and just was so worried about getting a shot blocked, he couldn't get anything going. Dante Exum had a couple of nice moments attacking the rim, although he missed some key wide open threes as well. He was being guarded by Alex Abrines, and I don't want to celebrate too much for Exum because Abrines is just not going to be able to stay with him off the dribble, but he was able to just cross over and go hard to the rim, and just good to see Exum attacking just that little bit. Burks, we already talked about his line in this one, 13 points, got to the foul line for 6 attempts, 2 assists. I mean, he's still, what he's going to have to get better at is finding someone other than just the roll man right in front of him when teams load up on the pick and roll. But he does provide an element just slashing to the rim that they have not had. And that's why, with Hayward being guarded well by Robertson and George Hill not having a great night, that's why they put the ball in his hands. He was a good guy to attack Enes Kanter. The key moment of this one, of course, because it's the Thunder, their bench didn't do very well in the second quarter, and then looked like they were gonna kill Oklahoma City in this at the start of the fourth. The Jazz actually went up 76-67 at the start of the fourth. Donovan called a timeout after they had scored the first 2 buckets of that quarter to get that lead. And he felt like, oh, this is going to be it. Like, they better bring Russ back in. They didn't bring Russ back in. And the Thunder bench actually brought them, went on, I think, a 8-2 run to get them right back into contact down three when Russ came back in. Campaign hit a big three when George Hill went off the strong side corner, which you're kind of not supposed to do, but Hill was able to get back and contest pretty well. Payne just made a really good shot, and the Thunder were able to scrape together a couple of buckets during that period that really left them within striking distance. Both of these teams, for all their size, weren't really able to do much on the offensive glass, aside for that key rebound by Steven Adams late. And then both of them were just really broke from three-point range. 6 of 20 for the Thunder, 5 out of 21 for the Jazz. The Jazz have been shooting incredibly well on three-pointers so far this year. That kind of came back to earth a little bit. And while the Thunder played well, I think a lot of this, too, was the Jazz just not quite making the shots that you would hope that they would make. And so I'm not like going to take much out of this other than just the Jazz missing shots in this game, other than just now with Burks back as well, the incredible number of options that Quinn Snyder has at his disposal. I think it's going to be difficult for him to pick the hot hand where they're going to go down the stretch of every game, whether it's going to be Favors at the four closing. I mean, I think they're the only guys that are going to be in there every time are probably Hill, Gobert, and Hayward. And then it's just whoever's got it going around those guys.
And remember, they still don't have Rodney Hood either. Like, that's how good
this is. Right. Yeah. Hood has been out.
Hood has been out. Yeah. Like, you think about, like, so when I saw how well Alec Burks was playing in this game, I'm a fan of his, have been for a while, especially because they have so much shot creation from their wings, that if they wanted to, and I don't think they should do this in the regular season, but they could just skip out their whole entire bench point guard problem by just playing Alec Burks there and just have stagger out.
Yeah, I think there's a concern that you're not going to get quite the amount of ball movement you want there, because sure. Burks is, he's kind of, he loves to reject the screen and drive to the rim, and he doesn't just like move the ball and reverse the ball. Like, when he gets a touch, he's almost always going to attack for his own offense.
Yes, he is.
So I think that's a little bit of a concern. And he's not going to play like this every night either. And he did have a very good matchup against, you know, going against Enes Kanter in pick and roll, wasn't being guarded by the best guy on the other team. But yeah, I mean, I'd forgotten that, like, we always forget one of these guys. Now that Burks is back, I'd forgotten about Hood. We should also mention the night that Victor Oladipo had plus 18 points, 8 of 11 from the field for Oladipo. Pretty outstanding. Was able to make some nice mid-range shots because, of course, as we know, the Jazz are impossible to score on at the rim if you're a driver. And so he and Westbrook were able to hit just enough of those mid-range jumpers to allow for not efficient offense for the Thunder. They only had a 102 offensive rating, but just get enough points against Utah, who, you know, I mean, they went through a crazy scoreless stretch of like almost 7 minutes in the third quarter, but they got just enough timely scoring to pull this one out. And they also killed it on the fast break too, with 25 points on fast breaks. I mean, that's so incredibly important to this Thunder team because they are just a bad half court offensive team, especially on the road.
The Jazz generally do a good job of limiting that, but they weren't able to in this game. Oklahoma City throws so many resources at it. And Oladipo had a nice stretch. He was a part of that fourth quarter run you talked about. I liked him. He did some nice things in that stretch. And I am still mad. I think I'm just going to complain about this every time I watch the Jazz, that I understand why Gobert and to a degree Favors and Joe Johnson, because he's old, don't run. But they have a lot of other people who can actually move and who can make good decisions in transition. And yet they do the least in transition of any team in the league.
Yeah, especially when you think of like all those shot blocks and missed layups that Rudy Gobert forces. Like, missed layups are a great opportunity to run. But yeah, I mean, Exum doesn't have the confidence to really push the ball in transition. George Hill has never really been a transition guy. Hayward is not a guy who's going to like push it down your throat either. I mean, Burks really is the only guy that you think of who has that kind of pell-mell aspect to his game at this point. All right, we done here?
Yeah.
All right, don't forget about our sponsor, Zeal. Use that CapSpace code to get $25 off your first in-home massage. And SeatGeek, the CapSpace code will get you $20 off via rebate for your first SeatGeek purchase. Going to have a special guest on tomorrow, hopefully. And then we got the Twitter NBA show on Wednesday, so probably won't get to the 15 and 60 maybe until next week. But that's okay. We've done a bunch of those in a row. So we'll keep giving you great content. We got lots of trade deadline previews coming up. And then a couple weekends from now, the mock trade deadline will be upon us. If you, I'll probably repost the one from last year. It was actually just to prepare for this one and kind of remember how we did it. I went back and listened to some of the one from last year, and some really interesting stuff and really interesting propositions, some prescient, some not so, about what we ended up with. I think last year we traded away Kevin Love for Danilo Gallinari and Will Barton.
Yep.
That looks interesting. Although, I mean, it's not like Love, other than that one play, actually did much in the finals. You know, maybe Danilo Gallinari would have helped him more. Who knows? But yeah, that was only one of the really interesting trades trade. I think we also did, we moved Pau Gasol to Miami, Hassan Whiteside to Portland, and Mason Plumlee to the Bulls, getting the Heat and the Bulls out of the tax. That was like one of the big trades that we had last year too. So it's going to be real interesting. Going to have Dan Feldman and Kevin Pelton, the usual suspects, on with Danny and I. So get fired up for that. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to y'all next time.